Chapter 17. Johnny DeLange was marking his shot holes. Lying on his side in the low stope of 27 section, he was calculating by eye the angle and depth of a side cutter blast to straighten a slight bulge in his long wall. In the Sonder ditch, they were on single blast. One daily, centrally fired blast. Johnny was paid on fathomage, the cubic measure of rock broken and taken out of his stope. He must therefore position his shot holes to achieve the maximum disruption and blowout from the face. "So," he grunted, and marked the position of the hole in red paint. "And so," with one bold stroke of the paintbrush, he set the angle on which his machine boy was to drill. "Shire, Madoda!" Johnny clapped the shoulder of the black man beside him. "Hit it, man!" Machine boys were selected for stamina and physique. This one was a Greek sculpture in glistening ebony. "Nikosi!" The machine boy grinned an acknowledgement, and with his assistant lugged his rock drill into position. The drill looked like a gargantuan version of a heavy-caliber machine gun. The noise as the big Bantu opened the drill was shattering in the low-roofed, constricted space of the stope. The compressed air roared and flattered into the drill, buffeting the eardrums. Johnny made a clenched fist gesture of approval, and for a second they smiled at each other in the companionship of shared labour. Then Johnny crawled on up the stope to mark the next shot hole. Johnny DeLange was 27 years old, and he was top rock breaker on the Sonder ditch. His gang of 48 men were a tightly knit team of specialists. Men fought each other for a place on 27 section, for that's where the money was. Johnny could pick and choose. So each month, when the surveyors came in and measured up, Johnny DeLange was way out ahead in fathomage. Here was the remarkable position where the man at the lowest point of authority earned more than the man at the top. Johnny DeLange earned more than the general manager of the Sonder ditch. Last year, he had paid a super tax on an income of 22,000 rand. Even a miner like Kowalski, who brutalized and bullied his gang until he was left with the dregs of the mine, would earn 8,000 or 9,000 rand a year, about the same salary as an official of Rod Arnside's rank. Johnny reached the top of his long wall and painted in the last shot holes. Down the inclined floor of the stope below him, all his drills were roaring, his machine boys lying or crouching behind them. He lay there on one elbow, removed his helmet and wiped his face, resting a moment. Johnny was an extraordinary-looking young man. His long, jet-black hair was swept back and tied with a leather thong at the back of his head in a curlicue. His features were those of an American Indian, gaunt and bony. He had cut the sleeves out of his overalls to expose his arms. Arms as muscular and sinuous as pythons, tattooed below the elbows, immensely powerful but supple. His body was the same, long and sinewy and powerful. On his right hand he wore 8 rings, 2 on each finger. And it was clear from the design of the rings that they were not merely ornamental. They were heavy gold rings with skull and crossbones, wolves' heads, and other irregularities worked into them, a mass of metal that formed a permanent knuckle duster. Of the big eyes in one skull's head, Rod Arnsides had once asked, "Are those real rubies, Johnny?" And Johnny had replied, seriously, "If they aren't, then I've sure as hell been gypped out of 3 rand 50, Mr. Arnsides." Johnny DeLange had been a really wild youngster until 8 months ago. It was then that he had met and married Hetty. Courtship and marriage occupied the space of 1 week. Now he was settling down very well. It was all of 10 days since he had last fought anybody. Lying in the stoop, he allowed himself 5 minutes to think about Hetty. She was almost as tall as he was, with a wondrously buxom body and chestnut red hair. Johnny adored her. He was not the best speechmaker in Kitchenerville when it came to expressing his affection, so he bought her things. He bought her dresses and jewellery. He bought her a deep freezer and a 15-cubic-foot Frigidaire. He bought her a Chrysler Monaco with leopard-skin upholstery and a Kenwood chef. In fact, it was becoming difficult to enter the Delange household without tripping over at least one of Johnny's gifts to Hetty. The congestion was made more acute by the fact that living with them was Johnny's brother, Davy. "Hell, man!" Happily, Johnny shook his head. "She's a bit of all right, hey?" There was an eye-level oven he had spotted in a furniture store in Kitchenerville the previous Saturday. "She'll love that, man," he muttered, "and it's only 400 rand. I'll get it for her, on payday." The decision made, he clapped his helmet onto his head and began crawling out of the stope. It was time now to go up to the station and collect the explosives for the day's blast. His boss boy should have been waiting for him in the drive, and Johnny was furious to find no sign of him, nor the pickaninny who was his assistant.
"Bastard!"
he grunted, playing the beam of his lamp up and down the drive.
"He's been acting up like hell."
The boss boy was a pockmarked Swartzy, not a big man, but powerful for his size and highly intelligent. He was also a man of mean disposition. Johnny had never seen him smile. And for an extrovert like Johnny, it was galling to work with someone so sullen and taciturn. He tolerated the Swazi because of his drive and reliability. But he was the only man in the gang that Johnny disliked.
"Bastard!"
The drive was deserted. The roar of the rock drills was muted.
"Where the hell is he?" Johnny scowled impatiently. "I'll skin him when I find him."
Then he remembered the latrine.
"That's where he is."
Johnny set off down the drive. The latrine was a rock chamber cut into the side of the drive. A flap of canvas served as a door. Beyond was a regular four-holer over sanitary buckets. Johnny pulled the canvas aside and stepped into the cubicle. The boss boy and his assistant were there. Johnny stared in surprise, for a moment not understanding what they were doing. They were so absorbed, they were unaware of Johnny's presence. Suddenly, realization dawned, and Johnny's face tightened with revulsion and disgust.
"You filthy!"
Johnny snarled, and catching the boss boy by the shoulders and pulling him backwards, pinned him against the wall. He lifted his heavily metal fist and drew it back, ready to hurl it into the boss boy's face. "Strike me, and you know what happens," said the boss boy softly, his expression flat and neutral, looking steadily into Johnny's eyes. Johnny hesitated. He knew the company rules. He knew the government labour officer's attitude. He knew what the police would do. If he hit him, they would crucify him.
"You are a pig!"
Johnny hissed at him.
"You have a wife," said the boss boy. "My wife is in Swaziland. 2 years I have not seen her."
Johnny lowered his fist. 12,000 men and no women. It was a fact. The actuality sickened him, but he understood why it happened.
"Get dressed,"
He stepped back, releasing the boss boy. Get dressed, both of you. Come to the station. I will meet you there.